camera so that the person can kind of see. Perfect. Although they might want to be a little closer to the microphone. And you might even just have to move the whole thing a little bit. All right. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'll go around and greet the people on Zoom, and then the people in the Zendo can introduce themselves, starting with Chris, Tyler, Jinryu, Bob, Marv, Paul, Zach, Alice, Betty, Simone, Mick, Coral, and Carson, and Joshua, Lori, Franklin, Sabrina, Marcia, Tracy, and in the Zendo, Andrew, Mark, Dennis, Walt,
Erica,
Ted,
Drew,
James, and Domio. All right. Let's see. Announcements. Can anybody think of any announcements? I'm sure there are some. Jukai is June 5th.
Everything was last weekend.
Yeah, everything kind of happened last weekend. We had a lovely vacation. I guess one of the things, oh, Bob, go ahead.
Just going to say, could you move the mic about a foot closer to you?
Kind of not really. I don't understand why this is low, because this is how it always is. This is, and if we move it any closer, then it's going to be really far away from the person who asks questions. Let me see if the audio settings in Zoom have been turned down for some reason. Okay, microphone input volume, is that any better?
Yeah, that's great.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know if this helped.
Might be a little high, actually.
Okay. All right, testing. How is that? I turned it down a little bit.
Okay, let's try that. Just don't get really excited, because I'll see it on the audio. Anyway, go ahead.
Because I can turn it down a little too.
Did you do that, Jen?
I did it just a smidge just before I spoke.
Okay.
Oh, now Jinryu's saying up a little bit. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I will leave it there.
Yeah.
But feel free to interrupt if there's any issues.
Okay. Thank you.
So the one thing that I was thinking about mentioning is last year I had the wonderful opportunity to take a sabbatical in the month of July. And Sangha members were very supportive of me doing that. So for the rest and the recoup and the study and all that. So I'm hoping to do that again this year, but it really does require a lot of Sangha support during that month. So in particular, that's 4 classes and 4 Sunday Sangha member talks that need to be scheduled. So I realize, you know, some of you still have precept classes to teach, and it's thinking ahead, but just keep in mind, if you have been around for a while and you have something that you'd like to share, even on a Tuesday, it can be like a discussion, just a article or a topic or something that you find very interesting, just putting that seed in people's minds so that you might be willing to step forward and lead something like that.
Have you already decided which month?
July.
July.
At that for this, I then will turn it over to James for the precept class.
Great. Get myself wedged in here. Every year it gets harder. Okay. Hello again, everyone. Seems like I was just here. Wow, I came in earlier and I thought, oh, it's going to be a light crowd. Wow, this will be easy. Now the pressure's on because there's all sorts of people out there, so I'll try not to screw it up too much. I feel like I haven't met some of you, so I'll just briefly say, my name's James Gregg. I've been a Sangha member here for a couple of years. Took Jukai in the summer of 2020, our first ever Bright Way Zen, socially distanced, fully masked Jukai ceremony. That was fun in the park. It's kind of nice. I spoke on the same precept last year, and I intentionally didn't look at my notes from that talk and came up with some new things to say, even though maybe some of you haven't heard them before. But so I am here tonight to talk about the precept on speaking honestly. And I chose this last year. I chose it again when Don put the call out. I was just right on it. Within 30 seconds, I replied to the email and said, I want that precept. The reason I chose it both times is because I feel like out of all the precepts, it's probably the one that's easiest for all of us to break, quote unquote, if we take the precepts as some kind of commandment or law, which we know they're not, but if we use that language of breaking the precept, I feel like that's the one that's the easiest. I don't routinely go out and harm people violently. I don't rob banks on a regular basis. So I don't feel like I struggle too much. Now, of course, I know there's much more depth to those precepts than just the simple surface analysis. But this is the one every day. Like, I feel like there's that opportunity to speak untruthfully. And I know I've personally had a lot of instances in my personal life in the past where I pretty much just outright lied, for a variety of reasons. And to the degree that that came back to haunt me or that came to bear in the consequences, the karma that generated came back on me at a later time and taught me a lesson on how to not do that anymore. But still, there's always that struggle. So, because I find this to be the meatiest, I'm going to try to not take up all of our time tonight. What I'm going to do, I'm just start off by reading the precept, and then I just wanted to say a few words about the precept itself. Some things that occurred to me in the last couple of weeks as I was really pondering this talk. And then there were some specific points in the Rosetto book that I wanted to. So I read through it, and the sentences that really jumped out at me, and I want to just say a few words about those. But I want to open it up, have plenty of time to open it up to your ideas, your thoughts, your questions, whatnot, on this precept. So, the precept: do not speak dishonestly, communicate truthfully. In the realm of the inexplicable Dharma, putting forth not one word is the precept of not speaking dishonestly. The Dharma wheel turns from the beginning. There is neither surplus nor lack. The sweet dew covers the earth, and within it lies the truth. It didn't hit me before, but it hit me a couple of weeks ago. Like, there's really three distinct parts to this. And maybe that's like, everybody's like, duh, of course there's three distinct parts to the. But, not only the main text of the precept itself, but then those last two, the second two sections. And I've really, over these last couple of weeks, I've come to really love that last phrase. The Dharma wheel turns from the beginning. There is neither surplus nor lack. The sweet dew covers the earth, and within it lies the truth. Because I saw something in that that I hadn't noticed before, that in my perception, and I could be wrong, of course, about this, but this is the way it landed on me, is that saying that the truth is just always there. just waiting to be discovered. And there's, the truth is everywhere. And I don't mean the truth is everywhere, like you, anywhere you look, there you find truth. I mean, everywhere is the truth, right? Everything is the truth manifest. It's just all there, waiting to be discovered, waiting to be realized, waiting to be uncovered. And so that really resonated with me, because I've been doing a lot of pondering lately about this idea of the backward step. And I know I referenced this even on the 10th when I gave the morning talk, that it's just, I have this sense of continually stepping back and back and back and further back from the delusory life, the life of ignorance, whatnot, and trying to get that objectivity to say, oh, there's where I'm kind of fooling myself, or maybe I'm fooling others, or maybe I'm engaging in some type of thought patterns or actions or behaviors that are not skillful and that don't actually get to that. And just to keep, I keep trying to step back to find that sweet dew that's covering the earth, you know, and to uncover and see that truth that is everywhere. So I'm doing a lot of sitting with that last phrase. Now, of course, the second section there, or the first section of the main text of the precept, in the realm of the inexplicable Dharma, putting forth not one word is a precept of not speaking dishonestly. That's the very Zen kind of, you know, and there's a lot of references you see in the literature, even in the Sinsin Ming, the verses on faith mind by the third patriarch Sengchan, there's a sentence that says, the more you talk and think about it, the further you wander from the truth. You know? And in the koan after koan, you know, the monk came to the master and the master said some words, and then the Zen master later on, who's commenting on that, says, "Ah, he totally blew it by opening his mouth. You know, he shouldn't have said anything. It would have been better if he just hit him with a stick." You know, and to this idea that, you know, hey, you know, Bob, you really want me to fix the audio problems? I could just be silent for the rest of the talk. That would be the most honest thing I could do, right? So, but obviously, that's a more absolute kind of, or transcendental maybe, kind of answer. And maybe that helps us in real life, maybe it doesn't. So coming back to that first phrase, do not speak dishonestly, communicate truthfully. What does that even mean? What does that really mean? And of course, there's the basic everyday run-of-the-mill answer, like, well, just don't lie. You know? But it's more than that, right? There's more to it. And I want to try to uncover some of that tonight. Because we have to speak, unfortunately. You know, my son is especially chagrined by the fact that I have to say words in his general direction on a regular basis. And he probably wishes I would be silent more often. So what is dishonesty? And why do we engage in it? There's, of course, speaking what we know is not true. Just outright lying. You know, like when we were kids. Did you break that vase? No, I didn't break the vase. You know, did you take a cookie from the cookie jar? No, I didn't take a cookie. Like, it's an outright lie, just bold-faced, plain old everyday lie. But can't we also include maybe the little white lies in there, right? So how do you feel about that, Dennis? And Dennis says, oh, sure, that's fine. Let's maybe need to massage that a bit, but, you know, is that the entire truth? Because maybe deep inside Dennis is saying, sorry to pick on you, Dennis, I don't know if you actually ever do this, but is there something, some deeper truth that Dennis is not telling, and he's presenting this other reality, right, to me in that moment? The little white lies, so to speak, right? How do I look in these jeans? You know, that's the classic, right? Don't tell me how I look in these jeans, because I really don't want to hear it, honestly. But what about staying silent when maybe we should speak the truth? And this is a big one, I know, that I have had issues with lately, where it's like you kind of want to say something, maybe you should say something, but you just stay silent, right? That lie of omission. And where is it skillful to actually say something? And where is it skillful to keep our mouths shut? Again, I'm going to talk a little bit about that tonight. The one that I it stands out to me because I personally struggled with this for a long time, is the dishonesty of presenting ourselves in a way that masks the true reality. that masks our true nature. For many years, I was a professional musician, and for it was all about image. You know, I had to be the guy. You know, I had to be the best player. I had to look the part. You know, I had to have the cool hair and the cool clothes and the whole nine yards. And then when I was on stage presenting myself, when I was the band leader, when I was the MC, whatever, presenting myself in this way that I thought I had to act. And to a degree, yeah, okay, it was an act. You're putting on a show. You've got to be a character, right? You know, like the Dean Martin. Dean Martin was never really drunk. Like a lot of times that glass was full of water, right? But he was putting on the Drunky Dean show, blah, 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 like that was full of scotch and he pounded in five bottles of it a day. Okay, so it's a character, sure. But is it really a character? And that was something I struggled with a lot, where I was trying to be that person. I wasn't, so, oh, I'm a character and I'm putting on that show. And then when I step off stage, I'm myself. It was, I actually want to be that guy all the time. Right? I want to mask my true nature. I want to hide behind this character. I want to hide behind the hair and the clothes and the persona and the attitude and everything else and be this other person. I saw a meme recently where it was some YouTube influencer, some young woman who, you know, with the makeup and the hair and the clothes and the whole nine yards. And she said, "Why do you grown men still play video games?" And a grown man responded, "For the same reason you wear makeup. It's a little escape from reality, isn't it?" I was like, okay, that might be a little harsh. But, you know, is there a way in which he was actually right? Is just even the act of putting on makeup, of doing our hair, of putting on our nice shirt, is there some dishonesty there? You know, like you could really stretch this to the nth degree, of course. So those are the kind of the general types of dishonesty that I know I try to work with, I try to ponder and try to find the truth in. There were particular passages in the Rosetto book that really resonated with me too. That I just want to call attention to. So for those of you who have the book. So the precept, I take up the way of speaking truthfully, starts on page 51 of that particular text. And the first line that really stood out to me, and I highlighted it and I put brackets around it in the whole nine yards because it just was like, so, this is just so me. You know? And to a degree, it's probably so all of us in a way. And that's right there in the second paragraph. There's an old saying that a person can't dupe others who hasn't duped himself first. It's just starting from, as we talk about dishonesty and honesty, starting from there, I think, is really key. Like, am I really, you know, is it telling the lie or is it something deeper? That I've fooled myself. I'm lying to myself. And that makes me capable then of externalizing the dishonesty and externalizing the lie. I shared in the Sunday talk, when I talked about some of my favorite texts, there was one I shared that I want to talk about again, because it just was like a smack in the face. And that's from the Stephen Batchelor Verses from the Center, where he takes Nagarjuna's prose and comments on it. And he states that freedom, true freedom, requires the patient, ongoing cultivation of an intelligence that is acutely aware to the dangers of self-deception. And I said this on Sunday, and I'll say it again, but it was just this smack of the gut. Like, I had to read that so many times to say, it comes down to the self-deception. The entirety of the practice is all about, for me, and again, I may not be speaking for anyone but myself and my own limited and diluted perception, but that danger of constantly deceiving ourselves, that the human brain is so good at, right? We are so talented as a species at just completely fooling ourselves into thinking, I need this, I don't need that, I need the other thing, I deserve that. And I wish that they would go away, and I wish that this person would go. Like all these stories that we tell ourselves are essentially in a form self-deception, and that the practice is about recognizing those moments. Like, oh, there I go again. Deceiving myself again into thinking that, I don't know why I always come back to this example. I need that chocolate cake. Maybe I just need to have the chocolate cake and just stop depriving myself. I don't know. Anyway, but just that story that we tell to justify our actions and our thought processes and our, you know, our actions of body, speech, and mind, right? As we chant, that all of these three modes where we get ourselves in trouble. I think a thing, then I say it. Oops, shouldn't have said that. I think a thing, then I do it. Oops, shouldn't have done that, right? That it's all about coming back to the dangers of that self-deception, moment after moment after moment after moment, bringing ourselves back, coming back to that recognition of our own self-deception. So, of course, most of deluded existence is exactly that, self-deceiving. Like I said, I need this, I don't need that. Worrying about our preferences, trying to keep getting more of what we want and less of what we don't want. And in a lot of ways, what are we willing to do to achieve those ends? And that's where we get into even some of the other precepts. Am I willing to harm people? Am I willing to take the gift not yet given in order to justify this lie that I have told myself and that I am now externalizing out into my relationship with the world? So that was one. That was one of my favorites. Let's see, a couple more. Make sure I'm doing okay on time. Yes, okay. So the next one was on page 53 in the text. I put my these glasses on. They're not doing any good at all. And that is on in the first main section of the book. We can sprinkle part truth with part lie, or we can try to create truth by presenting what we wish were true as if it were fact. That one really nailed me because, again, I recognize so much of myself in that phrase. Presenting what I wish were true as if it were fact. And that personal story I alluded to where I was always, you know, I mean, I worked in a business casual, well, I worked when we were still in an office, worked in a business casual environment. Like the tie I have on right now was acceptable. I wore a tie and a vest with slacks every day. Pocket squares, the whole 9 yards. You know, and I had a pompadour, you wouldn't believe the hair I used to have before I started this nonsense. Just always pretending to be far cooler and far better looking than I really am. Presenting that as if it were fact, because I wanted to make other people believe that I was, in fact, this really amazing person. And this is where that self-deception that I referred to in the Stephen Batchelor quote comes into play. I was deceiving myself into thinking that the real me was not good enough and that I had to put on this show. I had to present what I wish were true as if it were fact, because, of course, the real me couldn't be enough. Okay. The other one that I like, page 61. This was another good one. She's talking here about a student who had been a nurse and had been struggling with some problems. And she says, she'd been working with the precept for several months before she began to have a sense that what she was trying to keep silent was the belief that if she said what was on her mind, then she would be rejected. And of course, these are all tied together. So if you're not deceiving yourself into believing that you need to present a truth that is different than how it is really is and present it as fact, then you wouldn't be worried about rejection, right? It all comes back to this. What is the real truth of this situation? And if I tell it, and this is referenced in a later phrase there on page 61, or actually an earlier phrase, what's the worst that could happen if I told the truth? And a lot of the ideas around dishonesty and our choices to engage in dishonesty often come down to that. If I tell the truth, I will be rejected. And it's not necessarily even a conscious thought. Maybe in some ways it is, right? We say, oh, well, I couldn't actually admit that because then they'll get really mad at me and they won't want me around anymore. So maybe there's some degree of a conscious thought to it. But I think a lot of it is just a subconscious, like, oh, no, can't go there, right? And what is at the root of that? What is at the root of our fear of rejection, right? If we keep just stepping back and back and back, what is the ultimate truth? The sweet dew covering. And if I say, well, I can't tell the truth because I'll be rejected. Well, what's really at the root of that? Clinging to ego identity. Clinging and craving. My ego can't handle whatever rejection I feel like I'm going to receive. That violates my sense of self as me, and they are other, and I have to protect my space in this world. I've got to maintain my reputation. I've got to maintain my face, my good face, and my sense of who I am. And so earlier in page 61, that question came up, what's the worst that could happen? Would it really be bad to tell the truth, to be rejected, and to then have to deal with what that does to our ego identity that's at the root of our fear of rejection? Right? Oh, maybe if I can let go of that part of my ego, I don't have to worry about it as much. Right? What's the Mark Twain quote? Never lie and you don't have to remember anything. Or always tell the truth and you never have to remember anything, right? What kind of peace and calm could I attain if I stopped deceiving myself into thinking that I have to present something that I wish were true as if it were fact and then end up being dishonest because I fear being rejected? Right? All these phrases just tying together in this continuum of selfing that we do. Self with a small s, right? The selfing that we do. What's the worst that could happen? Could we uncover something more? And later on, or maybe earlier now, I keep saying that, looking at the book, but elsewhere on page 61, elsewhere, we'll say that instead. There's a phrase that invokes our favorite teacher, one of our very, very favorite teachers, Dongshan. Why I didn't highlight it. Where is it? I have an editing error. I'll have to talk to my editor and give him the what for over this. Anyway. It comes down to the truthfulness of just this. Just this. Our favorite, again, our favorite Yunyan Dongshan quote. And then this goes back to that latter part of the precept. The sweet dew covers the earth and within it is found the truth, or to something to that degree. Just this is it, okay. So that just this is the ultimate truth, right? Can I trust that? Can I trust things, as Dogen liked to say, things as it is? Can I just trust that to take care of itself and not worry about my ego and not worry about being rejected and not worry about presenting myself as something other than I am? Can I just trust this? Just this is enough. And just let be what is without pretense, without worry, without trying to make it into something else. And it comes down to what the real root of dishonesty is not trusting the truth, which is another statement that Rosetto makes in the book, and I didn't even put it in here. But we don't trust the truth to get done what we want to get done. We want to create something out of nothing, and the only way to do it is by deception. Deception first, and then external deception, even if it's in the form of not saying a single word, a lie of omission. Right? Now, unfortunately, there's another mention to this, and that is called out on page 57 in the text, where she alludes to the fact that, you know, we kind of can't really be too hard on ourselves because, quote, truth defies definition because it's changing so quickly that as soon as we've tried to grasp it, we've lost it. Now, that sentence in the text, she's referring to more of the absolute truth. But I think that applies to just everyday life, too, right? Am I lying if I say the sky is blue to somebody who's colorblind? You can't see the color blue? Well, not really, right? It's blue to me, but it's not blue to them. And that's an overly simplistic example, but there's a degree to which the truth is relative. And I really hate to say that because there are some things that are just, well, that's the fact. You know, that's just the fact of life right there. You can't really argue with that. But there's so much of our existence and so many of the decisions that we make that are predicated not on things like, well, the sky is blue. Well, I don't see it as blue. I see it as, I don't know what colorblind, blue colorblindness, what color it comes up as, but I don't know, see it as that color. I see it as this color. Oh, okay. Well, that's your truth and this is my truth. Right? That we're not talking about that. We're talking more about these lies of trying to create a reality that doesn't exist, right? The many times in my life that I outright lied to somebody's face about what I had done or where I had been or whatnot, I was trying to create a reality where I would not be rejected by that person for having done that or said that over here, which was the real truth, the real reality. So how much of that is relative? How much of it is based on our conditioning? What I see as truth may not be what you see as truth. Well, does that make it any less true? And if I speak from that truth, am I lying? Man, as if we weren't all confused before. I'm just going to throw this thing out the window. So, for my sake, at least, it really comes down to one thing. And she mentions this on page 63. This will be my last point, and then we're going to open it up for discussion. Page 63, and I think this is the real crux of it, and I think she knows that too, and she saved it for the last. It's actually in the conversations between her and the student, page 63. Always, 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 it comes back to the question, what is my intention? What is my intention? Am I speaking words that are not a true representation of reality for the sake of protecting myself from whatever harm may come if I told the truth as it actually was? What is my intention? My intention is to deceive this person and save my own butt. Is that a skillful intention? Probably not. Right? Or am I speaking from a place of truth where my intentions are good? I am trying to help. I am trying to open up. I'm trying to be a force for good. I live into my bodhisattva vows. If I'm coming from that place and I have something that may not actually be true, is it a lie? And there's no answer to any of this, right? There's no yes or no. This is always a lie. This is always the truth. And so the key here, I think, this has probably come up in the other precept talks, is what is your intention? Yes, but more of that statement I made at the beginning of cultivating an intelligence that is acutely aware of the dangers of self-deception. Not finding a solid yes or no answer. This is a lie. This is the truth. This is right. This is wrong. But rather to constantly assess every moment on its own merits for its truthfulness, and to make as skillful a decision as we possibly can from the best of intentions, from our bodhisattva vows, and to say, am I deceiving myself? I don't think I am. What's my intention? My intention is really good. I'm trying to help. Okay, I'm not going to worry about being rejected, and I'm not trying to put on a false front. I'm just going to say this thing, or I'm going to do this thing, and I'm going to hope it's the truth, and I'm going to hope it's good. And if it isn't, justice, right? We'll make it work. We'll fix it somehow. To me, that is the most honest way that we can live. Thank you. So, discussion. And yes, if you're in the Zendo, please come. We pick you up on the microphone well enough. And then those of you in Zoom land can do the little raise hand thing if you'd like, or I guess there's enough people, we probably should do the raise hand thing. I see Jinryu has her virtual hand up. Hello.
There's also little hands clapping as well. I don't know if I can have two reactions at the same time. Maybe I can. very well spoken. Lot of things to think about. I don't know that I want to think that hard about it. As I get older, I can't analyze every single moment. I think I look better with lipstick on, and I don't care what my intention is. You know, I'm not going to worry about that. You know, I went back in my mind, and I even Googled it, to one of my favorite books, which is Why Buddhism is True by Robert Wright. And he goes all the way back to basic human need of being in a community, having that partner, finding food and shelter. Also that we can get the right genes in the gene pool to keep the species going. And so all of these things that we do, you know, putting on the right clothes, putting our lipstick on, saying the things we say are just to keep those things going on. And he even goes so far as to say that, you know, we can actually tell little white lies or outright lies and say them so much that we really do believe they're true. But to me, this is, you know, I do appreciate the second phrase, the Dogen phrase, the sweet dew covers the earth. I think I appreciate that more now, having listened to your reaction to it. But I have always felt that of those two, the first one is my favorite, or it certainly has been to this point. Because that first phrase, and I don't have it in front of me, maybe I do, what is it? I don't have, what is it? In the realm?
Oh yeah, in the realm of the inexplicable Dharma. Not saying one word, I'm not quoting.
Not putting forth one word is the precept of not speaking dishonestly. I like that very much. And I like it, first of all, because it reminds me to be quiet. And I will, when I am meditating, if I can be quiet long enough, then I will see the truth that Dogen talks about in the second phrase there. And the crazy thing is it's right here. But because I've talking and thinking and doing all this stuff, it's completely invisible to me. I don't see it at all, which is the dilemma. But that first phrase also reminds me, it's not that I'm lying, it's just that I'm pathetically deluded. We're all deluded. So, you know, you said at one point, it all comes down to intention. I'm not intending to do this. I'm not a bad person. I just can't help. Up until I started to practice Buddhism with more intention, I was not able to help what it says in the part about anger, contriving reality for myself. So I love not putting forth one word. It gives me permission to sit back and be quiet. It makes me a better listener. It makes me a better witness. Friends don't understand that I can tell you that right now. It can get awkward, but it is so much more calm and peaceful. And you just jumped across my screen. I'm looking at you. So I'll be quiet, but it was a great talk. Thank you very much. Thanks for the energy. It really woke me up.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And I agree. It's just so, there's so much. And with a lot of these precepts, again, like I said, this one in particular, because it's just so easy to, you know, waffle on this one. Like, again, I don't waffle on like not killing people. Come on, you know, but the idea that the precepts bring you to a place of just putting attention around it, you know, things that we don't usually give attention to, right? Just thinking about things in a way that we don't normally habitually think about them. Like pre-Buddhism, like I'm with you, like I didn't think much about this stuff before I started practicing. And to just have that awareness around it, you realize how much I just stumbled through life just trying to protect myself, you know? And not in a really super terrible way even, just like little stuff here and there. Just I'm trying to create a reality that doesn't exist. There was one thing that I heard years ago, these in the Theravada tradition, they just do the five, do not kill, do not steal, do not misuse sexuality, do not speak dishonestly, and do not become intoxicated, just those five. And the way that it was phrased to me is like, these are not really about you. These are promises you make to others to do no harm. And, you know, like dwelling on past mistakes, praising, blame, that's all internal, right? That's for me. But like those five are really, really critical because that's where I'm engaging. And maybe if I'm praising self, blaming others, maybe if I'm dwelling on past mistakes, like there's parts of that that would come to bear on others as well. But like those are really obvious, like, you know, violations of other people's sanctity or whatever. I'm making up words now. But just that degree that's, those are promises to other people. My wife and I did a recommitment ceremony a couple of years ago, and my wedding vows were the five precepts directed at her in the context of our marriage. That was, you know. So just bringing the awareness around it and thinking about it in those terms of like, I can do harm or I can do good to myself and to others, and really living into that bodhisattva vow. Yeah, it, you know, like you said, like sometimes you have to stretch things here and there, or, you know, to what degree are you living into your vow? Even, you know, you don't have to analyze every single last thing. Now, you know, at exactly 7:02 p.m., I did this thing, and was that the right thing? Let me write out a, you know, chart and do a, make sure that I, you know, let's do a needs analysis to make sure that I spoke correct. Doesn't have to be that at to that degree, but just that initial gut reaction, like, oh, probably could have done that differently. So, thank you, Junrio. I appreciate it. I appreciate your what you said, bringing that to mind. So thank you. Mick has his hand up. Hey, Mick.
Yeah, thanks for talking about it. This is really great. I think what I like a lot about all of the precepts, is how they kind of are pointing us towards the truth. And in that sense, they're all kind of the same. That phrase that about the sweet dew, that actually was my favorite phrase, hands down. I remember it from the first time I read it. And actually recently, about 3 weeks ago, I got a tattoo on my arm. And I don't know if anyone can read it, but it says, "The sweet dew covers the earth, and within it lies the truth." So that's key. Nice. It reminds me of my practice every time I look at it. But to me, like, I think that it's like, I liked the analogy you made about the blue sky, because to me, the first phrase, the Bodhidharma phrase about speaking not one word, like, how could I convey to anybody the blue sky, the truth that's everywhere, right? Like that's not something that I can do. And I think that, like, what I think the precept is pointing us towards is that, like, that truth is your direct experience. And to put it in words is to take it outside of that truth. And in some respects, like, all of the precepts are just like that, because if I'm praising self and blaming others, I say, well, that's James talking and I know who he is and he's this person, that person. And I'm like, I'm denying the truth of this situation and I'm putting you in a box and I'm lying to myself about reality. I'm contriving a reality, for the self, which is the anger precept. So, like, all of these are tied up neatly to me in the fact that, like, it's everywhere, always around me, all the time. But my ability to convey that, it just fails completely and utterly the moment I open my mouth. And I just think, I don't know, I think it's so cool.
Thank you, Beck. Wonderful. I'm going to have to up my tattoo game now. You outdid me. Anyone in the Zendo? Franklin's got his hand up, too. All right, Franklin, I'll call on you.
Yeah. Hi, James. Thanks for your talk. It was very thought-provoking for me. Hopefully you can hear me. I guess I'll have to ask the standard boomer question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Anyway, I took three notes or three things that really stuck out to me. And the first thing was when you were talking about things that we can lose if we wholeheartedly embrace the truth. And it got me thinking that in general, I think it's true. We are afraid of vulnerability. You know, I think that's a thing. And our egos prevent us from going to that place in many instances where it's perfectly safe to do so. But then I also maybe think, like, well, you know, this will tie into my second point too, that, you know, sometimes the truth does have a price, right? Like, if you 100% walk around telling the truth all the time, you're going to hurt people. Like, for example, if I happen to tell my wife every time I saw a woman that I had, I thought was attractive, I don't know how long my marriage would last. So, you know, I mean, there's truth. And then there's, I guess, right speech is the way I want to think about it, right? There's the Eightfold Path, which, of course, I don't remember which one it is, but right speech is an important aspect to that. So that was something I wanted to point out. And then there was a discussion around self-delusion, which I really liked. And that's something I think about often, maybe not enough, but it made me think of that beautiful quadrant, right? The known known, the known unknown, the unknown known, and then the unknown unknown. And it made me think about, you know, how this is the thing that I always, you know, I don't stay up at night worrying about it, but I do think about this and think, what about all the diluted stuff I do that I don't even know about? Like that, you know, hopefully that doesn't keep anybody up tonight, but, you know, sometimes that gets in my head and I'm like, it's the stuff I don't know that I'm doing, I'm deluded about, right? I've been so successful at deluding myself, but I'm not even aware of it. So that's something to think about. Apologize for that. And then I guess I already touched on this. lies of omission versus right speech. My son, when he was a little kid, used to love to start off certain observations / criticisms with the phrase, no offense, but, and then he would go on to like drop the bomb, whatever that was, right? And I guess that ties into the whole thing about right speech and how there's this really, in my mind, a delicate balance between, you know, being 100% truthful and also being cognizant of people's feelings and whether, you know, whether speaking is even appropriate, you know, even if it is the truth, you know. So anyway, thanks a lot for your presentation. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, there's a component to that, that Eightfold Path right speech that I like. And I think I talked about it last year when I gave this talk, but the three questions that you can ask yourself, is it, I hope I get it right, is it true? Is it necessary? And is it kind?
Right.
I may have messed that up.
No, I think that's exactly right.
Okay, yeah. And so that if you filter, if you can, I mean, to Jinryu's point, you can't just, you know, analyze every single thing you're going to say before you say it. But to the degree that you can hit those three points, like, is it true? Yes. Okay. But is it necessary? No. You know, and is it kind? No. Okay. Well, then don't say it. Right. So yeah. Just because, to your point, right, that just because something's true doesn't mean it needs to be uttered. Doesn't mean that it's not going to do some harm. So that's the second and third, is it necessary and kind, kind of help you, you know, from making those kinds of faux pas to the wrong people at the wrong time about the wrong thing. So, thank you, Franklin. All right. We have about 8 minutes, so more questions or comments?
I guess I wanted to open up the conversation a little bit to the when we don't speak up when we should. I know that for myself, I grew up in the Midwest, and who knows if is it my culture, is it my personality, whatever. But I really don't like conflict. So that, you know, is it disagreeable? Are people going to react badly? You know, if that's the case, then I'm pretty much, I'll try to do anything else besides have to say something. Yeah. And, but afterwards, sometimes it's like, especially even if it's just about me, but certainly if it's on behalf of other people, you know, that feels, it feels wrong. It feels like I have broken a precept, not speaking up. But I know that, I don't know, for me there's, I'm not good at it at all, but a little, the whole nonviolent communication thing makes some sense to me, because I feel like that's a way to move into that territory and stick to the truth, because when I'm moving into the conflict, I want to state something like, here's my case and why I'm right, and like... And that doesn't work. That just creates the conflict. But the, can I speak, can I be vulnerable even as I speak this truth that might be disagreeable? Like the example people have heard me said, I used to go to this gym and we all work out together at this Orange Theory Fitness. And this guy would just, he would let out these yells in class, and he was meant to be like, we're all supposed to be encouraged, but it was like, rah! And it was just this blood curdling, like, I mean, my whole, I don't know if there were other people who had trauma. I don't have past trauma, but even I was like, hormones are just going through, stress hormones are going through my body. And I'm like, and then the whole rest of the class, I'm sitting there worried that he's going to yell again. And I was like, but I could not bring myself to say anything to him, because I just had all these, imagined all these, you know, the rejection and the conflict and the ugh. I don't know. So I never said anything. I just put up with it. But that's the kind of example of like, how can we move into that territory? and say something, and yet not not try to validate for the self.
Yeah, that's hard. Yeah, I love that nonviolent communication. And that I appreciate you saying that, because that's the thing. It's like you can say, okay, well, is my intention good? Yes, my intention's good. Okay, is it true? Yes, it's true. Is it necessary? Yes. Is it kind? Yes. Okay, great. But that still doesn't give you the words to say, or the mode in which to say them, right? You could still justify coming out like, you are so dead wrong. You must be the biggest idiot on the planet. Okay, maybe that's not kind, but you know, yeah. I think that discomfort with conflict is what leads us to that same fear of rejection that she talks about in the book. Like, if I say what I want to say, you're going to think ill of me. You're not going to like me. You're going to want me gone. You're going to yell at me back or something, you know, to whatever degree we justify it. But I love how can you back into the truth in a more subtle way? And that nonviolent communication does a really good job of that. And I have benefited a lot, because in my work life, in the early years, I was the one that was always getting talked to by his boss for being too direct, because I didn't have that. I would say, that's wrong. You know, like I would, something that somebody had created, that's not going to work. You know, maybe I wasn't quite that blunt, but people got bent out of shape because I was a little too direct in my honesty. And even then you could put quotes around honesty, because was it really true or was it just my truth? You know, but, you know, to cultivate that ability to come from a place of compassion and say, hey, I don't want you to feel like I'm confronting you. I don't want you to feel like you're going to have to get defensive. So I'm going to try to spin this in a way that makes you feel valued and respected and all that. But I'm going to still get to the truth, right? So that's so hard. Yeah, that's so hard. So thank you.
I've noticed that I've done a lot of traveling, and it's given me this space to be wrong and to hurt other people at times. But I was always, you know, I can't talk to people, you know. But in the travels, I learned that most of the things I said were kind and necessary. Maybe not all, not completely necessary. And occasionally things really hurt people. But I would do it all over again, because when people were hurt, I responded in a very compassionate way. And I think taking the risk is what's important here, you know. None of us is going to live forever. Having a little risk and being wrong and hurting someone is something we're going to do in our lives. So I discovered it was a way to allow myself to have my spontaneity without having to quash it. And I know that sometimes I'm not going to be accurate or wrong, and I know that I will respond in a compassionate way if that's the case. So I appreciate your forceful voice. I had no problems hearing tonight.
So I was telling Bob, you don't have to worry about the mic with me. See, it's a vestige of me trying to be somebody else, right? The loud guy. Thank you. Yeah, nobody on Zoom, I guess. Maybe we're done.
Do you know the verse?
I could give it a try. I think I know it.
All right.
Abiding in this ephemeral life, like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is free and goes beyond. That's the word I got.
Okay, that's pretty close.
That's close. Thus we bow to Buddha. All beings throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thank you, everyone. James.
Well done, James. Well done.